Hello and welcome to another of our business podcasts. I'm Jane Chan, editor of Small Biz Pod. Today we are recording our 100th podcast, and to mark this milestone, what better place to be than at the London office of the British Chambers of Commerce, where I'll be talking to its president, Martin Pellew. By sheer coincidence rather than by design, we recorded our very first podcast back in 2005 with David Frost, then Director General of the British Chambers of Commerce. So this is a great opportunity to revisit some of the business issues and concerns to see whether anything has changed or progressed for the better. We'll also be looking towards 2013 and what this might mean for startups, small businesses and would-be entrepreneurs. And we'll also find out what the organisation is doing to support businesses to grow and create jobs. For those of our listeners who may not have heard of the British Chambers of Commerce, it is an independent and not-for-profit network which has been going for an incredible 150 years and represents 104,000 members who collectively employ around 5 million people in the UK. It is true to say that Martin has had a very varied management career in the UK and internationally. He now concentrates on non-executive roles as well as being president of the British Chambers of Commerce. Let's start with the main issue we raised in 2005, the old chestnut of the need to reduce red tape, which governments often claim to want to do, but yet most businesses say there's always more that should be done. Do you think, Martin, that there has been any progress at all?
Yes, I do think there's been progress. Apart from anything else, Jane, the government has now got deregulation very firmly on its agenda, and it has set things like a one-in, one-out rule, whereby any new legislation and regulations have to replace at least one existing one. The problem we seem to be struggling with still is that we still get a lot of regulation coming in from Europe through our membership of the European Union and the European Parliament. For example, as an organisation, back in July this year, we produced a booklet which is all about the red tape challenge and helping some of the businesses and some of the trade sectors that we operate with to identify those regulations which are most interfering with them. So I think progress has been made. I think it should always go faster. And things like, for example, the simplification of the tax regulations in this country, trying to get away from the still very complex number of tax items that we have, including national insurance contributions, sitting alongside mainstream corporation tax and income tax, would be the sorts of areas where one would look for concentration in the future.
Right, and what about other areas? You mentioned the EU, so what more can be done? I mean, it's very difficult to not go with the flow.
Well, I agree with you, Jane. It is difficult. But, for example, last week I was in Brussels talking there to members of Parliament, members of the European Parliament, and to some of the bureaucratic people there as well, about the fact that we need to spend more time well in advance of potential changes in regulation. Because what happens is if we leave it too late, it becomes a done deal, really, which is other areas in Europe have accepted to do things which we don't accept, and it's too late for us to block those. So I think from a business point of view, us as a trade association in the British Chambers, we need to be more proactive earlier on. A recent example would be with the ergonomics directive, where a number of new health and safety type legislation changes were likely to be imposed upon British organisations. That could have potentially added a lot to the cost base. And so we've been very vociferous in trying to block the specifics of that. And what we do there is we get hold of case studies from particular businesses. We get those businesses to talk to the Eurocrats, as I will call them, to try to stop these things at birth rather than when it's too late.
I suppose it's a very fine balance to have, because obviously with businesses you need some regulation to safeguard and protect customers and consumers and the business itself. And on another level, there's a lot of paper filling and form filling and perhaps unnecessary regulation. So how do you target which ones you are actually lobbying for when there's hundreds and hundreds of regulatory issues going through the EU and UK Parliament?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Of the existing legislation, we tend to, and regulations, we tend to work with members We go through those which are causing them problems. So, for example, the number of health and safety executive inspections that take place on small businesses, very small businesses. And we've made good progress there in reducing the threshold such that, you know, small businesses don't get imposed upon too early. What we also do is we try to make sure that we give an early warning from our work lobbying and talking in Brussels in particular with MEPs to the business community of what they're contemplating. So if they're going to make a change in 3 to 4 years' time, they have to think about it, they have to go out to consultation. And what we try to do is make sure that when the European Parliament are consulting, or the European Parliament's effective bureaucrats from the bureaucratic side are working on the administration of changes, that they talk to us and we talk to our members to make sure we've got the right perspective. So this can be about health and safety, it can be about employment law, it can be about energy, in particular things like the carbon regulations that are coming through, which are generally all in the right direction. Nobody does these things just to make it worse, but sometimes they don't see the hidden impacts, and that's what we're looking for.
Let's move on to the current economic environment, which continues to be fragile in the UK in spite of some recent upbeat statistics for the economy, like inflation at a three-year low, employment at a record high, borrowing far less than predicted in the first 6 months of the tax year, and economists are expecting growth of between 0.4% and 1% from July to September. So what are your views on Chancellor George Osborne's deficit reduction plan, which has been dubbed Plan A, which is indicating that we are to expect greater austerity over the next two financial years than in the current one?
Okay, Jane, well, the first thing to make plain is that we've been long-term supporters of the deficit reduction programme. We believe that the centralised overspending on large numbers of areas has caused the problem, at the same time as the restrictions that are being imposed on the banking community, because they've overtraded and are now trying to re-strengthen their balance sheets. So by and large, we are very supportive of deficit reduction. We do see it as being fundamental to the success of the UK economy. Having said that, the economy, despite those good signs that you've just mentioned, particularly the way the private sector has created a million jobs, which is hopefully going to offset some of the reductions that need to take place in the public sector in the UK, that and the other points you make are such that at the moment the economy has, for the last three quarters, probably been bumping along fairly stagnant. And what we've been encouraging is that beyond just simple deficit reduction, we need to see a consistent series of policies to help stimulate growth of the UK economy, and particularly for UK companies.
So when you say you're in favour of Plan A, you're in favour of Plan A, but you have some conditions, i.e. you would like to see some stimulus also at the same time, which actually almost veers towards Plan B of injecting investment and growth.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jane, I think we at the British Chambers of Commerce would be very keen at the very outset to make sure that people don't get into a slanging match with the media about Plan A and Plan B, because this isn't just a short-term political football to be kicked about. What we feel is that the UK economy has over 5 to 10 years, certainly in the early 2000s and the late 1990s, has developed into a very strongly structured centralist government policy of overspending. There's been a large growth in many of the departments and their spending levels, and that has caused the fact that the government has needed to borrow a lot of money, it's run into deficit, and the banks have really struggled to provide money through, for example, to small businesses for them to grow, particularly on exporting. So, not interested in whether it's Plan A or Plan B. What we want is deficit reduction. We think that's important. But we also want a consistent and rather more long-term approach to some of the measures that will help stimulate the economy. What we don't want, by contrast, is a lot of short-term measures and a continuous stream of new initiatives. And that really is one of the messages we try to get across to not only George Osborne, but to Vince Cable, which is a little bit more consistency about the way they approach the business sector.
OK, now let's talk about credit, because there has been an overfueling of credit during those periods of years that you alluded to earlier. So now we almost have gone into the other pendulum swing, where we're finding small businesses are struggling to access credit. And Vince Cable, business secretary, announced recently the creation of a £1 billion government-backed business bank to improve lending at reasonable rates. But there exists a number of similar financial support initiatives already, like the National Loan Guarantee Scheme and the Bank of England's Funding for Lending Scheme. Yet businesses are still saying that it's getting more difficult to obtain credit. So what do you make of all this?
Well, I absolutely agree with the sentiments that you've expressed there, which is that as I go up and down the country visiting various businesses and members of the Chamber network, there is a cry that access to finance is one of the, if not always, the number one problem that they are facing. Small businesses in particular, because they don't have a track record of good credit history, they don't have a track record of paying back money, and because they are seen to be, and are quite rightly, a generally higher risk. So small businesses, by which I mean businesses that are trying to lend to borrow money from bank lending of less than £1 million, where they're in start-up positions, probably with less than 10 people, these are particularly hard hit and are not getting access to finance. Why is that? Well, it seems to me very straightforward and very simple, which is that the private sector banks, starting with the demise of Northern Rock up in the northeast of England, which was 5 years ago now, really, we saw a run on the banks. Some of the banks, in particular the ones that are now in the public sector, had an overrun of lending to unsubstantiated funds of mortgages, particularly in the American market. And what they've got to do now is they've got to re-strengthen their balance sheet. You've got what I call a catch-22. The banks are told to strengthen their balance sheets, so they're being very strict on their credit rulings. They've tended to centralise away from local decision-making so that the process to get access to finance is very slow to get borrowings approved. And it just hasn't been working. There have been a number of government initiatives, but these have not yet worked their way through into actually helping the businesses that I go out and talk to.
So what do you think about the £1 billion government-backed bank, though? Do you think it's a good idea? Would it alleviate some of these issues you spoke of?
Yes, Jane. I mean, the British Chambers of Commerce have been pushing for this for over 9 months, really. Obviously, the ideas have been worked through with Vince Cable's department, and we've been consulted throughout as to how this might work. But that is part of the problem. You've got to set up the administration to make the process of, if you like, get encouraging small businesses to ask for loans. And it's looking for loans that where other banking methods and other access to finance has not so far succeeded. And then you've got to make sure you can do this in a speedy way, because one of the great things that puts businesses off is bureaucratic paperwork.
But the other issue is going to be is actually the risk assessment. Won't this bank have the same issues that the high street banks have about assessing risk of small businesses? The very problems that you spoke of earlier, won't it still exist for this bank as well, and it will slow the process down?
It will, Jane, and that is part of the problem, that just because they set this bank up with whether it's £1 billion or however much more they'll have to put in, doesn't automatically mean that companies or individuals that have got ideas that frankly aren't going to fly will automatically get a loan. So there will be a risk assessment, and one has to worry a little bit about what will be the levels of interest rates. My own experience in helping raise money for some of the smaller businesses that I'm involved in has been that individual banks have turned them down, including incumbent banks who've been the lenders of overdrafts so far, or have previously been willing to lend money, have suddenly said, well, I'm afraid we're under such constraints that we're no longer lending to smaller businesses, or we're not lending to that particular sector. So what the Bank for Business needs to do from a government point of view is it needs to have a broad brush of which sectors it will lend to. It needs to have market rates that are competitive, and it needs to, if you like, bundle together a number of loans across small businesses so that if one or two go down, it doesn't bring the whole show down.
But ultimately, the taxpayers are taking the ultimate risk.
Well, I think how they're going to fund this and where they're going to get the money from and how they're going to administer it are all parts of what's going to take probably up to 2 years to make this happen. But you're quite right, yes, ultimately, a bit with the as with RBS or with any of the other banks where the government's had to step in and support, the taxpayer is effectively being asked to underwrite some of the risk that these banks are no longer taking. But if we don't do that, there won't be enough money around to have a healthy small business sector.
Do you think £1 billion is enough to set up this bank?
I think it's an excellent start. I think until such time as we've got to a further level of requests for finance and we've seen what is the acceptance rate and the failure rate, then it's a good place to start. You only have to look at some of the other alternative government schemes. They've just announced the third round of the Regional Growth Fund, which is £1 billion worth, and that's the third round. So £1 billion going into the larger companies which are creating investment and jobs in those regions of the country that have been most hit by public sector cuts is what they've done with the RGF. £1 billion in a third tranche does actually somewhat agree with your statement there, Jane, which is that £1 billion being lent to small businesses is probably not enough, but it's a good start.
All right, let's move on to exporting. There's been a lot of talk that businesses should look to overseas markets for growth. However, this is against a backdrop of concerns about the future of the euro, the general economic woes of several countries in the eurozone, and China's growth rate slowing down. As I know, Martin, exporting you have a lot of first-hand experience of. So what would be your advice to businesses thinking about expanding through the export route in this tough economic climate?
Right, as you say, Jane, I've got some experience. This year alone, for example, I've made visits to, for example, India. I've been to Australia, particularly Western Australia, and I've been to Spain. And as I said to you, last week I was in Brussels and talking there about just this sort of issue. Back here, I've had an opportunity to meet with some of the European countries that are keen to attract UK exporters. Most recently, I met the Deputy Prime Minister of Lithuania, some people from Kosovo, and so on, some of the smaller countries. I think it's a complex issue. If you read the media at the moment or you listen to the news, we've almost given up on exporting to mainland Europe because of the euro crisis. And yet, most of those countries are very well established. They've got good-sized markets. They've got distributor networks. They've got an ability to deal with Britain. So we mustn't lose sight of Europe. And despite the fact that there are attractions around what's called the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India and China, and I heard now that there's a new one called the N11, which is the next 11 countries. This was a concept, I think, announced at the Tory Party conference when I was there up in Birmingham a couple of weeks ago, about what are the other countries, and that includes places like Indonesia and Mexico, where there are large populations and a developing economy. I think there are many opportunities, but first and foremost, I would tend to look at Europe. My business background in the most recent years has been up in the northeast of England, and there a lot of manufacturing is done by the processing and chemical sector, with products being produced from the oil that came off the North Sea and being exported into mainland Europe, because the UK is a good base from which to do your logistics and your manufacturing and serve the markets of Germany, France, Poland, Spain, Italy and so on, and the rest of the 27 that are in the EU. And these are countries that have relatively small balance payments difficulties normally, although for the last 3 or 4 years it's become such that one worries about their governments, and therefore that's having a net effect on some of their buyers not having the money. But for example, last week I met the ambassador and the UK TI team in Brussels, and they're very keen for UK exporters to see Brussels as a well-developed market.
But so, if you're a small business, how can you access these markets?
Well, you have to have a product, and you have to understand those markets, and you have to find maybe a distributor, or you have to find direct customers. There's nothing new about a new country for exporting. It's just the same as if you operate in the southeast of England and suddenly decide you're going to expand in Scotland. You've got to do your homework and you've got to do your research. The one place that I think has upped its game is the local offices of the UKTI, Trade and Industry. Whether it's their representatives based in the UK or it's their offices attached to the embassies overseas, these are the best and first place to start. And, you know, I'd have to say it, wouldn't I, Jane? You have to start with your Chamber of Commerce. They can help you. They've got other businesses that have got expertise. If I give you a practical example, in August I was up in Scotland visiting the chambers there, and I went to Aberdeen and I participated in a seminar about exporting to Angola. Very interesting. There are, I think it was between 65 and 70 companies there, all very keen to export to Angola. And when I refresh your memory, of course, Angola is very good for oil and gas, and it was industries in Aberdeen where there were a lot of opportunities where people were trying to understand how to export to Angola. Secondly, I went to South Wales, to Newport, and I visited the Chamber of Commerce there, And it turned out that they have a very strong affiliation with the Bangladeshi community, and they had the ambassador for trade and the representative minister for trade over from Bangladesh visiting South Wales. And then thirdly, I also went within the last month to Hull and to the Hull and Yorkshire, Hull and Humberside area, and visited the chamber there, and they've got very strong ties with the Caribbean, probably because it's a traditional port. What I'm trying to show you here
is... So it's kind of a twinning process, is it?
Well, it's a twinning process, but what if you're in South Wales and you want to export to Angola, then you need to know that up in Aberdeen there are people there that can help you. And similarly, if you want to deal with the Caribbean and you're in Newport, South Wales, then there's somebody in Hull that can help you. So the network of chambers, understanding that we offer the best of everything everywhere to companies, is a very good place to start.
So are you saying that if you're a member, you'll be able to access some of these opportunities?
Yeah, you'll be able to get information and help by finding out what other areas and what other countries are being dealt with around the globe by various chambers. Frankly, nearly all of the 50 chambers that make up the network are very keen on China, on India, Brazil, Russia, because these are the larger countries. Probably having been there myself recently to India, with the fact that they do speak English, although there are cultural differences, there's a very good opportunity there. But you need to know who are the chambers of commerce there. There's a British Indian Chamber of Commerce. There's also their own version of the Chambers of Commerce. Getting those contacts, meeting, as I did, with the UKTI staff in New Delhi, these are excellent places to start. And you need to understand that there are pockets of geography there, some of which are very keen on the IT sector, some of which are very important for, say, infrastructure and energy, others of which are strong logistics hubs. So there are pockets. It's a massive place. It's a billion population. It's physically much larger than us. You've got to concentrate. As a small enterprise in particular, you need to prioritise as to where you're going to go, get the research and do the work.
Well, you just give me a key word, prioritise. Right. What are the three priorities the British Chambers of Commerce will be focusing on for its members?
Well, not surprisingly, you've already hit on two of them. One will be access to finance. We will continue to lobby very long and hard to get this Bank for Business up and running, to help the banking community and the existing banks like Barclays and RBS and so on, to lend money to businesses if they've got good business cases, and try to make sure that we are freeing up the ability to grow. The second thing is we will be helping exports. That's the second priority for the BCC. So, for example, we have an international trade conference at which we've got some very good speakers, mainly with case histories about good practice of how other people have done it, how they've grown from being in a UK base to being overseas exporters. So using those as good examples, but also making sure that the information flow of how you get certificates of origin, if you're sending out products, and how you deal with overseas embassies, how you get translation services, how you do money exchange. These are sorts of products and services that are vital as well. And the third thing, after access to finance and helping imports, will be we will continue to prioritise infrastructure investment. We believe it's very, very important that the infrastructure in the UK is fit for purpose to grow the economy over decades to come. And so in particular, we'll be lobbying government to take a long-term perspective, to get on with some positive decisions, to put diggers in the ground, to make things happen. For example, particularly on transport, we're a bit dismayed by how long they're going to take on an aviation policy around the London airport question. But not only is it transport, be it marine ports, be it roads, be it airports, but we're also very keen at energy and the issues that have been holding up the growth of renewable energy. Particularly wind farms. When I was in Hull the other day, they were very keen to see some inward investment by a German-based organisation that had been held up by some uncertainty over energy policy. There's the utilities, be it water and the very large Thames sewer system. There's broadband, where not only do we want the cities in this country to have excellent fast-speed broadband, but to make sure that gets rolled out to rural areas so businesses can work throughout the country. And the last element of infrastructure where we're looking for a bit more help is in the skills area, where we're looking to support new drives on improving education, getting people skilled at the jobs that we will have in the future, and getting those people, particularly the what has been, although it's luckily, as you say, the figures have got better, but the million unemployed under the age of 25, and we've been very keen to make sure that they are prepared for work. So getting those through the education system and ready to work is something we've been looking at as well. So infrastructure is the third area, and it covers, you know, at least five very complex areas. It covers a lot, yeah. It
covers an awful lot. You've certainly got your hands full. And finally, we always end with some tips to inspire our listeners. So what three tips of advice would you give small businesses to help them grow next year?
Well, Jane, I think giving businesses any advice is always a risky thing to do. At the end of the day, it's the energy and enthusiasm of the 4.8 million businesses in this country which will drive the economic recovery. Of those, something like 210,000 have got more than 10 employees. So they're the larger companies, the ones we see that have become successful, got themselves off the starting blocks. What do they need to do? They need to plan ahead. If they're going to grow with investment and taking on new people, then they need to look for finance, and they need to plan ahead for what their finance is going to be. I've already said that some of the new access to finance ideas, like the Bank for Business, are going to take time to get off the ground, and therefore you need to do your homework, you need to get a good liaison with your bank, you need to find the right routes, maybe talk to your Chamber of Commerce, maybe talk to UKTI about overseas access to finance. But all of those things are about planning ahead. So my first tip to people is to plan ahead, because unfortunately in the current climate, particularly accessing new money takes a lot of time. I think the second thing I would talk about is you need to learn from others. You know, it's your energy and enthusiasm as a small business that will make you succeed, but you don't want to fall into the same traps as somebody else has done. So networking and talking to other entrepreneurs, talking to other small businesses about people who've done it before and learnt the lessons is a good thing to do. And again, Jane, I'd have to say it, but one of the best ways of doing that is to join a trade association such as the British Chambers of Commerce, because that's where you can meet other businesses in a good, friendly environment, and they will help you learn. And the last tip is the one about my own career or about businesses in general. It's pretty obvious. Just be lucky. You need to find the right opportunity and seize it when it comes your way. Finding new markets, finding new customers, finding new opportunities is never easy. What you've got to do is concentrate on recognising an opportunity when it comes. If you're going to take a career change, you're going to move out of corporate life and set yourself up in a business, do some homework first, make sure you've got access to finance, know where your friends and helpers and colleagues are that can give you a help and advice, and just be lucky, which is find the right opportunity, find the right market. If it doesn't work first time, don't make that the last time you do it. I think one of the things we admire about American businesses, and they've had such things as the Small Business Administration there for a long time, is that in America, failing is not the only option. If you fail once, it doesn't mean you can't start up again and do something else. So being lucky is about having the resilience as well as finding the opportunities to make sure that if your first idea doesn't work, it doesn't mean you can't be a successful entrepreneur. You just have to regroup quite quickly and get back on the horse.
On these golden nuggets of advice and guidance, thank you, Martin Perry, for sharing your thoughts with us today and giving us an insight into how the British Chambers of Commerce is supporting businesses.